Good morning. Our third case this morning is 2020-1187, the State of Ohio versus Daniel J. Campbell. For the appellant, Mr. Reamer.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor and fellow justices, and may it please the court, Christopher Reamer on behalf of the Fairfield County Prosecutor's Office in the State of Ohio. For appellant, I have with me today also Mr. John Rockenbach, representing Amicus, the Ohio Attorney General's Office, who also briefed this issue. I'd ask to reserve 5 minutes of time for Mr. Rockenbach regarding this argument. Thank you.
Now, he will be on reply or direct? You want 5 minutes?
Chief Justice, I've heard that sometimes that flows. If on direct, we can work that through the questioning. I'd like to do that.
Okay.
If for some reason I go over my allotted time, I'll hand off rebuttal to Mr. Rockenbach in this matter.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your Honor, appellant State of Ohio comes before this court today based upon two vital interests. Those vital interests request this court reverse a judgment of remand from the Fifth District Court of Appeal regarding a motion to suppress on an issue related to consent to search in Ohio Statute 295102 and the interplay between those two provisions. This case is vitally important because, one, specific to the case, it ensures a felony probationer who is in possession of child pornography will stand convicted of the contents that he possessed during his period of supervision of multiple events of child pornography. More importantly.
But Counselor, that's the ends. We have to talk about the means.
Your Honor.
Just because the means justifies the ends.
Yes, Justice Stewart.
So we have
Stewart.
To talk about the constitutionality of searching the cell phone.
And Justice Stewart, as, more importantly probably, is this court's guidance to Ohio trial courts as to whether or not they can validly, as a term or condition of probation, condition that a probationer must agree to warrantless, suspicionless, random searches as a condition of their probation.
And is that a blanket agreement to search anything and everything at all times, at any time?
Justice Stewart, it has typically been couched as search of the person, search of their property, search of their motor vehicle, and search of their residence. As we will probably get into and hear a little bit about this case, there's a nuance that's come in, and that has to do with electronic data and cellular telephones. But at the point in time the search was conducted related to this matter, the electronic devices were considered to be personal property of Mr. Campbell and were searched on that basis.
Normally it would require a warrant to search a telephone, correct? Not a probationer, but someone who's not on probation.
Case law establishes that an individual such as a recent arrestee, their constitutional rights would require that law enforcement obtain a warrant for the search of that phone. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so in this matter, the trial court orders the probationer to waive all privacy rights, really?
Yes, Justice O'Connor. What occurred in this case is the defendant was serving a prison term related to a robbery conviction. In December of 2017, he applied for and received judicial release. Consistent with that, the trial court ordered a term that, amongst other things, required that he allow probation officers to search his personal property.
So he had no option. He had no choice.
Justice Stewart, there actually case law establishes that he did in fact have a choice. He could have objected to that term or condition at the time the original trial court requested him to do so. There is case law that suggests, although
How would that have worked out for him if he had told the trial judge he wasn't going to agree to that?
Justice DeWine, I I don't know where we would stand at this point in time. I think the trial
probably
judge...
He probably wouldn't be on probation, would he?
Perhaps not.
But Mr. Reamer, in reality, doesn't the potential probationer agree to follow the rules of the probation department, and it's at that time, not stated by the trial court, but at the time they go to the probation department and sign up, that they find out that they have to consent to a warrantless search to follow the rules of the probation, correct?
Justice Bruner, there were written terms and conditions of probation that you will find in the case file that I included, and as an exhibit, the defendant signed off on those terms and conditions upon receiving his judicial release. That is typically done at the time the trial court grants it. I was not present, so I do not know if, in fact, it was same day, but there is a date on that.
So it was judicial release to community control.
That's right. Within a month, his assigned probation officer met with him again and covered those specific terms and conditions, and there was testimony during suppression. He had no questions about that and no objections to that.
But whether it's judicial release or just straight sentencing to community control, I don't recall that there's anything that the trial judge has to say at the time or that's in the agreements except to follow the terms and conditions of probation as determined by the probation department, correct?
The trial judge has broad discretion to put together terms and conditions as they see fit for the probationer's terms and conditions.
Okay, and just one quick follow-up question.
Yes.
So if we agree with you that it's constitutional to require this consent, we don't even need to get to the good faith exception in the second proposition of law, do we? Because once it's consent, it's blanket and there's no question about a warrant, right?
I would agree with you, Justice Bruner. If you agree that the trial court's ability to request and gain a consent for random, suspicionless, warrantless searches of probationers as a term or condition of probation, if that coexists side by side with 295102, then no, there's no reason to get to the second prong or the good faith argument.
Thank you.
Counsel, Campbell's original waiver or agreement consent form did not specify telephone in it. Is that correct?
No, Justice Donnelly. It did not. It purely stated
property.
Property. Okay.
Property.
And then it was later amended for other probationers. How come his wasn't? How come he wasn't brought in and told this includes your telephone?
I think that those probationary terms were likely changed based upon the development of case law related to telephones and data contained within. I don't know that answer specifically. I would contend that a cellular phone does constitute an item of personal property for most of us, and it's fairly obvious to the average individual, if they're using reason and common sense, that their cell phone is an item of personal property.
Shouldn't there be a nexus between what the person's on probation for and why they would search? For instance, if someone was on probation for possessing illegal sexual materials, it would make sense for probation officers to search computers and telephone. But he was on probation for a robbery. What would be the necessity for the probation officer to check the telephone?
I would point out, Justice Donnelly, frequently felony offenders have additional conditions that make access to their telephone consistent with rehabilitative efforts by the state of Ohio as well as safety of the community. They frequently use illegal narcotics. They frequently may
be... Counsel, there was no suspicion of any of that with this probationer. In fact...
That is correct, Chief Justice.
There was no reason to suspect anything that would be characterized as noncompliance with the terms of probation.
That is correct, and the probation officer that was assigned testified to that effect. This was a normal house check. She testified that it was her understanding and belief, based upon her training and experience, that this was a constitutional search for which the probationer had consented, and she had met with him. I would point out as to that too, as to the argument that 2951.02 has somehow legislatively superseded a trial court's ability to obtain a consent search. The Fifth District relied on a holding in Griffin versus Wisconsin. Griffin versus Wisconsin didn't even consider, and it wasn't an issue, whether or not the defendant in that case had in fact validly consented to a search of his person. So it wasn't addressed in that court. The Fifth District believes that 2951.02, which didn't exist pre-Griffin and didn't come into enactment until 1995, was based upon Griffin. But Griffin...
Do you think when the legislature passed 2951.02 that they thought it would be kind of a dead letter and that courts could just do whatever they wanted and get around it?
I think, Justice DeWine, the better understanding in this case is that the legislature passed 2951.02 in reaction to the Griffin case, and the standard that was articulated is reasonable grounds. And I think more properly, how we consider the statutes at play here, the trial court's discretion to set probationary terms, and 2951.02 is this. If a probationer is not subject to that type of search term, then there is a floor level. A supervising officer then must have reasonable grounds, and written notice must have been given to that offender.
Why wouldn't we think about it like this, that a court has to have authorization to impose a community control term? Here there's a specific statute that talks about what kind of authorization, it talks about searches of probationers and gives courts authorization to do that, and that since the legislature has specifically legislated in that area, that's the standard that courts can apply. They don't have any authority to apply a different standard.
Well, I want to point out one thing. When the Ohio Supreme Court considered State versus Benton, 2951.02 had been enacted. In fact, the Second District, Montgomery County, held that regardless of the consent search authorized by the offender, it required reasonable grounds because 2951.02 had been enacted at the time. And the Supreme Court, in overturning the Second District, said, no, the offender validly consented to an unlimited, warrantless, suspicionless searches, and that works coextensive with 2951.02. That's the last time, based upon my research, that this court has directly addressed that issue. So the last authoritative precedent we have is suggestive. Consent search still exists in setting probationary terms, and numerous courts of appeal in this state continue to rely upon that. That also gets me to the second point, which is we have a situation here, and I know we've talked about good faith and whether or not we need to get there. We have a situation here in which courts of appeal may have differing versions of whether or not they can do this. But the trial court in this
in this case, Counselor, the Fifth District concluded that Benton was legislatively superseded by 2151.02.
Yes, Chief Justice.
Okay, and if you start from that premise, then how they rule is appropriate.
I think that premise is flawed.
I understand that, but that's what I guess that's what we have to decide. The role of 2951.02 in light of a trial court, any trial court, making conditions, that a parolee or probationer has to follow.
I would only point out the Fifth District acknowledged in State versus Storer, a Fourth District case, that was directly in opposition to the Fifth District's position. The Fourth District believes an offender still can be validly required to consent to random suspicionless searches. Directly in contrast. Secondarily.
Well, you don't disagree that probation officers are statutory creatures?
No, Your Honor, I do not.
You don't disagree that courts are statutory creatures? We only have that power to which is extended by the Constitution or the statutes?
I do not disagree with that.
Would you agree that that language is cabining the powers of a probation officer to require reasonable suspicion? Language of the statute cabins their power.
I do not think the language of the statute acts exclusively. And the reason for that is this. Consent to search has been recognized in the common law for many years. And authority of this court suggests when the legislature intends to overturn a general common law protection, it'll be explicit
issue isn't really the consent. The issue is the probation officer's authority to search, right? I mean, regardless of what someone consents to, if a government actor doesn't have the authority to do that action, they can't do it. You can consent to me shooting you, but I'm not allowed to shoot you. I'm a judge, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. However, we also have what is a statutory versus a constitutional violation in this case. And it's a statutory, if you believe it's a statutory violation, it's a statutory violation for which the General Assembly provided no remedy. There's no language in the statute about what should happen if a probation officer mistakenly or inappropriately follows this. And if the court follows its prior decisions in State versus Jones, where there's a statutory violation, in that case, territorial jurisdiction of a police officer, the court said, statutory violation, concerning, but not a constitutional violation. And the Fifth District's opinion readily concedes there is no constitutional violation here. So we have a statutory violation for which the General Assembly has provided no remedy.
So is the statute just good advice then? I mean, if there's no remedy for it, what incentive does anyone have to follow it?
Justice DeWine, I understand your concern. My remedy would be this. If the General Assembly believes that their will is not being followed by law enforcement or probation officers in the state of Ohio, then it's their duty to amend the statute. But it is not for a trial court or any other court to suggest what that remedy should be.
So if you're, what you're saying, if we believe that 2951.02 remains in place, and the judge or the probation department cannot make an order that flies in the face of that statute, and they do, and the defendant, you know, is there's contraband or whatever is found, isn't the question what do you do with the results of that search that are statutorily precluded?
That's correct, Chief
and
Justice.
You say, they should be let in.
Correct.
All right, and it's just as valid to say they should be excluded.
It's clear it's not a constitutional violation. It's acceptable. It's an acceptable search based upon the consent to search, based on U.S. Supreme Court precedent. California versus Sampson has made that clear. The Benton case, which is the most authoritative case from this court, on point, remains good law, while courts of appeal may express some confusion. Many trial courts continue to rely upon Benton. And so it's constitutional under that basis. There's no provision for a remedy under the statute, and it could have been done so. I noted in my brief there are other statutes in which the General Assembly has imposed a remedy. They know how to do so, and they did not do it here.
Would you agree that this looks like boilerplate? It falls at the end of the trial court's entry. It looks like boilerplate. There's no checkbox in front of it as discerning as it's a real condition of probation. It just looks like it's boilerplate to anybody who's going to sign that document. Would you agree with that?
I think it is boilerplate in terms of the terms and conditions of probation, Justice Kennedy. However, in this particular occasion, the defendant went over it with the probation officer, didn't object. And frankly, he didn't bring an objection at the time he was judicially released either. Instead, he waited until there was a problem and then raised an issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You use your time. Mr. Wood. So what do we do about the fact there's no remedy spelled out in the statute?
Well, Your Honor, if the Court of Appeals decision is correct and that RC 295102A is the only way in which a community control officer can search a probationer, then that would be a statutory violation. The Court of Appeals admitted that they were not going through a constitutional analysis in this case.
If you moved, say, to a probation revocation, which would flow directly out of this in addition to new charges, is that structural error because of how unconstitutional it is? Because consent sort of takes it out of the statute. And so you really have to get to this question about, is it okay for courts to require this as a condition of being out on the street instead of locked up in a prison? This is apples and oranges. Consent takes it out of the statute, so we don't even worry about the question of exclusion. But the real question, which you've posed, is can a court actually require this?
Well, and that is the issue in this case, is whether or not the search provisions of 295102 coexist with a waiver or a consent to be searched by a probationer.
Right, because do you agree with your colleague that there's already case law that says requiring this consent is constitutional?
Yes, I understand the state's argument that they coexist, and I think there is strong authority out there for that, namely State versus Benton by this court, and also Sampson versus California.
Counties aren't required to use consent forms with their probationers, right?
They are not required to use consent forms.
Not so. Maybe perhaps this statute just exists for those counties that don't require consent forms.
And that may be true. And I did attach a case to my brief, which is a federal case, U.S. versus Fletcher. It's a Sixth Circuit case, our circuit, 2020. And I think they dealt with a similar issue in the fact that they were dealing with a probationer. They found pornography on the phone. But in that case, the consent to search that probationer signed indicated that they agreed to search the person, motor vehicle, and place of residence. Nothing else. And so what Fletcher did in that case is, well, there's no consent to search. Then they went to the statute. And they went to the statute and he said, was there reasonable grounds for the search? And they found there wasn't. So I think they can coexist. But getting back to the Chief Justice question, even if it is a statutory violation, I think exclusion may still apply. And I think this court recently in State versus Dibble, a 2020 case, indicated that exclusion may be a proper remedy in a non-constitutional violation under certain circumstances.
Well, how do you get around what we said in Kettering v. Holen, where we said that, quote, we will not apply the exclusion rule to to statutory violations falling short of constitutional violations absent a legislative mandate requiring the application of the exclusionary rule. That was a case involving a warrantless search. The interest certainly seemed to be at least as strong in that situation as this one, and we said there's no exclusionary rule doesn't apply.
And I would agree that the case law on that issue is abundant. However, in State versus Dibble, this court did open up that door when it said that it may apply to non-constitutional violations, and it referenced a federal case and specifically identified two circumstances. One is if there was prejudice in the search because the search would not have occurred. Was there prejudice? Because would they have found the information without the search having occurred? And then also mentioned a second reason why exclusion may apply, and that is if there was intentional and deliberate disregard of a rule. And I think both those aspects may apply. However, Justice DeWine, it's important to note that the Court of Appeals below did not address the exclusionary rule. They simply found that this was a statutory violation. They remanded the case back to the trial court, and I think it was the trial court's role at that point to determine whether or not the exclusionary rule would apply or not. So I don't believe the Court of Appeals addressed the issue of whether or not the exclusionary rule applies with regard to this statutory violation.
Counsel, let me ask something. In the record, we've got the consent form. We got testimony about the probation officer going over it again. When he was searched and they asked to see his cell phone, did he object? Is there anything in the record on that?
There's nothing in the record to reflect that he objected to that. I think there was testimony that he was questioned as to whether or not it was his phone. Okay. He acknowledged it was his phone, and they simply took it and searched it.
Taking that, can people waive Fourth Amendment rights?
Certainly they can waive it.
And can they waive statutory rights?
They can waive statutory rights as well.
Isn't that what we have here?
Well, with regard to a constitutional waiver, it has to be voluntary, it has to be knowingly, and it has to be intelligently waived.
This was judicial release, right?
It was judicial release.
He could have said no, right?
He could have said no, and I understand that voluntary may be an issue when you're looking at a prison or supervision under these terms. However, this court said in Benton that a choice between two attractive positions is still a choice. So I wouldn't necessarily argue it wasn't voluntary, but I would argue as to whether or not it was knowingly and intelligently made with regard to cell phones.
Did he have counsel with him at the judicial release time?
Yes, he did have counsel.
Okay, thank you.
So the issue is whether or not what he waived at the time of judicial release, because he specifically said, I consent to searches of my person, my property, my vehicle, and my residence at any time without a warrant.
And isn't a cell phone property?
Well, that is the issue. Because cell phones, here recently, by this court and by the U.S. Supreme Court, have been found to be something different than just normal property. Based on the information that can be contained in a smartphone, based on the information that can be accessed by a cell phone.
Right, and that's why a warrant is normally necessary, but you can waive that and voluntarily turn over your cell phone.
Well, the question is what was it clear and unambiguous?
Because what was clear and unambiguous?
Whether or not the consent to search signed by Mr. Campbell, was it clear and unambiguous to him that property included cell phones?
And counsel, that's why I asked, is there anything in the record him saying you can't look at my cell phone?
At the time of the search?
Yeah.
No, there's nothing in the record to reflect that. So he didn't verbally object to it at the time of the search.
And he didn't object to it at the search or once they're scrolling through it?
Correct. But the question is whether or not at the time that he waived, at the time that he consented, which is at the time he was granted judicial release, not at the time he was searched, but at the time he was granted judicial release, was it clear and unambiguous to him that the word property included a cell phone? And
Wait a second. You need a warrant to search a cell phone, right?
Correct.
You normally need a warrant to go into somebody's house.
Correct.
All right. Need a warrant to search somebody's car. Okay, these are all things that need warrants. And a cell phone warrant is no different than a home search warrant.
The warrant itself is not different, but the properties, but the subject of the search is different. Searching
sure
someone's home, searching
sure.
someone's
one's
vehicle.
One's a phone and all the information in it. The other is your home and all the information and property in it. So there is no special heightened, protection for a warrant to a phone as opposed to a warrant to a house.
Well, I believe that this court and the U.S. Supreme Court have held that a cell phone, a smartphone, is different. And as
is different than what?
Different than anything else that we may carry around on our person.
Okay, I'll agree to that. Anything you're carrying around on your person.
And as Justice Roberts said in the Raleigh versus California decision that dealt with cell phones, a cell phone contains the privacies of life. Almost anything we do is within that cell phone. And I did cite this court to U.S. versus Lara, which is a Ninth Circuit case, 2016, which dealt with whether or not the term property includes cell phones. Is it clear and unambiguous?
This is a new argument for you, right? You didn't make this argument below.
Well, this argument was made below. The Court of Appeals did not get to that argument, but this argument was made in the courts below.
That was one of your assignments of error below?
I'm sorry?
That was one of your assignments of error below?
Yes, and in fact, the grounds upon which the Fifth District ruled in this case was not necessarily an argument that I was making, that the statutory search provisions of 29-5102A is the only way upon which a probation officer can search a probationer, but that is how they ruled. But I did raise this issue below, and that is whether or not the consent and the waiver that Mr. Campbell made using the term property included cell phones.
Shouldn't we extrapolate from this court's precedent and the United States Supreme Court precedent about the uniqueness of a cell phone or electronic devices such that either specific consent to search those devices are needed, or in other instances of arrest, a warrant needs to apply before any law enforcement official can search that item. Shouldn't we extrapolate that?
Absolutely. I think this case presents that opportunity for this court to make that distinction with cell phones and smartphones as opposed to any other property. And I believe that the precedence out there by this court and the U.S. Supreme Court support that distinction.
Counsel, what about a laptop?
Absolutely, a laptop as well.
Okay, so that's the same category as a phone.
In the sense that it contains the same information that may be in a phone, but a laptop may be different from a cell phone in the sense that most people don't carry around a laptop wherever they go, but certainly most people carry around a cell phone.
Do most people carry a wallet?
A lot of people do. Some people do, absolutely.
Those get searched often when somebody gets arrested or whatever.
But wallets may not contain...
Contain some pretty personal information, right?
Pretty personal information, but not to the extent that is contained in a cell phone.
And well, if I search a house and I found somebody's diary that they wrote in every day for 10 years about their personal thoughts and doings, that's pretty personal.
That is personal.
And that would be recoverable by the state on a search of a home.
But I think a cell phone contains much more than that. Not only the information contained in a cell phone, but the information you can access from it. The bank accounts that you can access, the photographs, the conversations that you've had with individuals through messenger or texting. I think that this court and the U.S. Supreme Court have already identified the cell phone as a very unique object in modern day life and how that fits into our constitutional protections. In U.S. versus Lara, the Ninth Circuit case said cell phone is of such a special nature that you cannot assume that it's within the term property. And because it was not clear and unambiguous, when Mr. Campbell signed the terms of his judicial release that property included cell phones, there was no waiver. And because there was no waiver, because there was no constitutional waiver, then you do have to rely on the statute, just as they did in Fletcher. And because there was no reasonable grounds to believe that Mr. Campbell had violated the terms of his community control, then the search was unlawful, not only from a constitutional standpoint, but also from a statutory standpoint.
Counselor, for the record, over here.
I'm sorry.
For the record, we always carry our laptops around, so okay. Just this court.
And most attorneys do as well, Your Honor.
Mr. Wood, Mr. Wood, if we're saying that the statute applies, then talk to me a little bit about why the search doesn't fit the requirement that it be a reasonable search. I mean, what did under the statute?
The statute requires two things. First of all, it requires the trial court to put the person on notice that they are subject to a random, suspicionless, warrantless search at any time during the period of their supervision. There was no evidence that there was any written notice provided. The second requirement of the statute is that there must be reasonable grounds to believe that the probationer is either not abiding by the law or not complying with the terms of their
That's the one I'm getting at, since they didn't mention cell phone. So we've got to look at whether or not there were reasonable grounds to believe the offender is not abiding by the law or otherwise not complying with the conditions of supervision. So was there anything that the state can stand on to say that they had reasonable grounds to get into his phone?
No, I think it's undisputed that there were no reasonable grounds to believe that Mr. Campbell had violated the law or have not been in compliance with with the terms of his community control. I think that's undisputed. I believe the community control officer testified to that. In fact, the reason why the community control officer was conducting the search was they were going to move him from a reporting status to a non-reporting status. He was doing so well that this search was kind of the last step before they moved him. So there was no indication, no reasonable grounds, to believe that he had violated the law or not complied with the terms of his community control.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Your time is up. Okay, Mr. Reckenbach, the time has exceeded. You may take a minute.
Okay. I'd like to make three quick
points. If you can take your mask off. Thank you.
I'd like to make three quick points, if possible. The first, touching on a question by Justice Donnelly and Justice DeWine, we believe that the point of this statute, the search provision, is to establish a baseline condition of parole that all of these offenders are subject to these searches, but that doesn't abrogate the statutory authority, as mentioned by Justice Kennedy, of sentencing judges to impose additional appropriate search conditions. Now, those search conditions could be reviewed on a case-by-case basis under this court's decision in Jones. But the plain text of the search provision does not claw back any authority. It says that probation officers may conduct warrantless searches if reasonable grounds exist. It does not say that probation officers may conduct warrantless searches only if reasonable grounds exist. Now, to get to a point that you raised, Chief Justice O'Connor, what is the remedy of this statute, assuming counterfactually that the Fifth District read it correctly? We agree with the state that under this court's precedence in City of Kettering, it is not the job of this court to write the exclusionary remedy into state statutes. That said, there would be different possible recourse that a person might have depending on two hypothetical worlds. One is where there is a probation condition that authorizes warrantless searches, and one is where there isn't. If there is no condition authorizing these searches, then we would go back to a Fourth Amendment problem. But that's not the case that we have here. Here, there is a search condition. And so because they had the search condition at the outset, a probationer or a judicial releasee could challenge that condition either to the sentencing judges or perhaps on appeal, and then it would be subject to the review under State v. Jones. So even though there's not the exclusionary remedy, we believe that there is recourse.
Wouldn't there be a ripeness problem there?
Well, I believe that—
You haven't been injured by the search yet.
I believe that in the case of probation, perhaps you could appeal the condition on direct appeal. as for, in the case of judicial release, perhaps a mandamus award, I guess the ripeness could be a potential problem. If possible, I'd like to get to the third point, which is the cell phone question. I'll just note that the Fifth District didn't address it and it hasn't received full briefing here, so we think it would be appropriate, if the court is concerned about that question, to remand to the Fifth District to answer it in the first instance. But I would also just like to point this case, this court, to the Arizona Supreme Court's decision in State v. Litzow, 248 Arizona 576, where it said that that the term property includes cell phones. And I would also just like to say,
when was that case decided?
I believe it was 2019 or 2020. And as that case pointed out, the language of the condition in the Laura case is a little bit different than what we have here. The word property in the Laura case was further qualified as something along the lines of including person, container, or residence. We don't have that kind of qualification in this case. The Ninth Circuit pointed that out at Laura. I'll also note that the Ninth Circuit, in a case called United States v. Johnson, said that it was cabin to probationers, whereas here we have someone who's on judicial release, and under the Supreme Court's decision in Sampson, people on parole effectively have fewer lower Fourth Amendment expectations, and so we don't think that the clear statement rule that would be required to say that property doesn't include cell phone would be appropriate in this case.
One more question, if you wouldn't mind, Chief. So under your analysis, if the cell phone is not deemed to be property, and I know you disagree with that, then the statute applies. And if there are no reasonable grounds, you said there's a Fourth Amendment problem. So if there's a Fourth Amendment problem, I mean, and regardless, the statute, according to the way you're looking at it, would not allow for exclusion. So if you've got a Fourth Amendment problem, where does that leave the trial court? Basically structural error or what?
I apologize for the lack of clarity in my answer. The Fourth Amendment problem would only come up in a case not like this one, where there is no search condition, because the Supreme Court has said in Sampson that where there's a search condition, that's sufficient notice. In a hypothetical case where there's no search condition then and no authorization from the statute, then you could have a Fourth Amendment problem.
Assuming that property covers cell phone.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?